The Way to Love, The Last Meditations of Anthony DeMello, by Anthony DeMello. Be awake. Blessed are those servants whom the Master finds awake when he comes. Luke 12:37. Everywhere in the world, people are in search for love. For everyone is convinced that love alone can save the world. Love alone can make life meaningful and worth living. But how very few understand what love really is and how it arises in the human heart. It is so frequently equated with good feelings toward others, with benevolence or nonviolence or service. But these things in themselves are not love. Love springs from awareness. It is only inasmuch as you see someone as he or she really is here and now, and not as they are in your memory or your desire or in your imagination or projection, that you can truly love them. Otherwise, it is not the person that you love, but the idea that you have formed of this person, or this person as the object of your desire, not as he or she is in themselves. Therefore, the first act of love is to see this person or this object, this reality as it truly is. And this involves the enormous discipline of dropping your desires, your prejudices, your memories, your projections, your selective way of looking, a discipline so great that most people would rather plunge headlong into good actions and service than submit to the burning fire of this asceticism. When you set out to serve someone whom you have not taken the trouble to see, are you meeting that person's need or your own? So the first ingredient of love is to really see the other. The second ingredient is equally important, to see yourself, to ruthlessly flash the light of awareness on your motives, your emotions, your needs, your dishonesty, your self-seeking, your tendency to control and manipulate. This means calling things by their name, no matter how painful the discovery and the consequences. If you achieve this kind of awareness of the other and yourself, you will know what love is. For you will have attained a mind and a heart that is alert, vigilant, clear, sensitive, a clarity of perception, a sensitivity that will draw out of you an accurate, appropriate response to every situation at every moment. Sometimes you will be irresistibly impelled into action. At others, you will be held back and restrained. You will sometimes be made to ignore others and sometimes give them the attention they seek. At times you will be gentle and yielding, at others hard, uncompromising, assertive, even violent. For the love that is born of sensitivity takes many unexpected forms, and it responds not to prefabricated guidelines and principles, but to present, concrete reality. When you first experience this kind of sensitivity, you are likely to experience terror, for all your defenses will be torn down, your dishonesty exposed, and protected walls around you burned. Think of the terror that comes to a rich man when he sets out to really see the pitiful condition of the poor, to a power-hungry dictator when he really looks at the plight of the people he oppresses, to a fanatic, a bigot, when he really sees the falsehood of his convictions, when they do not fit the facts. The terror that comes to the romantic lover when he decides to really see that what he loves is not his beloved, but his image of her. That is why the most painful act the human being can perform, the act that he dreads the most, is the act of seeing. It is in that act of seeing that love is born, or rather more accurately, that act of seeing is love. Once you begin to see, your sensitivity will drive you to the awareness, not just of the things that you choose to see, but of everything else as well. Your poor ego will try desperately to blunt that sensitivity because its defenses are being stripped away, and it is left with no protection and nothing to cling to. If you ever allow yourself to see, it will be the death of you. And that is why love is so terrifying. For to love is to see, and to see is to die. But it is also the most delightful, exhilarating experience in the whole world. For in the death of the ego is freedom, peace, serenity, joy. If it is love that you truly desire, then set out at once on the task of seeing. Take it seriously and look at someone you dislike and really see your prejudice. Look at someone you cling to or something you cling to and really see the suffering, the futility, the unfreedom of clinging, and look long and loving at human faces and human behavior. Take some time out to gaze in wonder at nature, the flight of a bird, a flower in bloom, the dry leaf crumbling to dust, the flow of a river, the rising of the moon, a silhouette of a mountain against the sky. And as you do this, the hard, protective shell around your heart will soften and melt, and your heart will come alive in sensitivity and responsiveness. The darkness in your eyes will be dispelled, and your vision will become clear and penetrating, and you will know at last what love is. The Mountain of Prayer. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Matthew 14:23. Has it ever occurred to you that you can only love when you are alone? What does it mean to love? It means to see a person, a thing, a situation as it really is, and not as you imagine it to be, and to give it the response it deserves. You cannot love what you do not even see. And what prevents you from seeing? Your concepts, your categories, your prejudices and projections, your needs and attachments, the labels you have drawn from your conditioning and from your past experiences. Seeing is the most arduous thing a human being can undertake, for it calls for a disciplined, alert mind, whereas most people would much rather lapse into mental laziness than take the trouble to see each other and thing anew in present moment freshness. To drop your conditioning in order to see is arduous enough, but seeing calls for something more painful still, the dropping of the control that society exercises over you, a control whose tentacles have penetrated to the very roots of your being, so that to drop it is to tear yourself apart. If you wish to understand this, think of a little child that is given a taste for drugs. As the drug penetrates the body of the child, it becomes addicted, and its whole being cries out for the drug. To be without the drug is so unbearable, a torment, that it seems preferable to die. Now this is exactly what society did to you when you were a child. You were not allowed to enjoy the solid, nutritious food of life, work and play and the company of people, and the pleasures of the senses and the mind. You were given a taste for a drug called approval, appreciation, attention, the drug called success, prestige, power. Having got a taste for these things, you became addicted and began to dread their loss. You felt terror at the prospect of failure, of mistakes, of the criticism of others. So you became cravenly dependent on people and lost your freedom. Others now have the power to make you happy or miserable. And much as you now hate the suffering this involves, you find yourself completely helpless. There is never a minute when, consciously or unconsciously, you are not attuned to the reaction of others, marching to the drum of their demands. When you are ignored or disapproved of, you experience a loneliness so unbearable that you crawl back to people to beg for the comfort known as support, encouragement, reassurance. To live with people in this state involves never-ending tension, but to live without them brings the agony of loneliness. You have lost your capacity to see them clearly as they are and to respond to them accurately, because mostly your perception of them is clouded by your need to get your drug. The consequence of all this is terrifying and inescapable. You have become incapable of loving anyone or anything. If you wish to love, you must learn to see again. And if you wish to see, you must give up your drug. You must tear away from your being the roots of society that have penetrated to the marrow. You must drop out. Externally, everything will go on as before. You will continue to be in the world, but no longer of it. And in your heart, you will now be free at last and utterly alone. It is only in this aloneness, this utter solitude, that dependence and desire will die, and the capacity to love is born. For one no longer sees others as means to satisfy one's addiction. Only someone who has attempted this knows the terror of the process. It is like inviting yourself to die. It is like asking the poor drug addict to give up the only happiness he has known, and to replace it with the taste for bread and fruit, and the clean, fresh morning air, and the sweetness of the water from the mountain stream. While he is struggling to cope with his withdrawal symptoms and with the emptiness that he experiences within himself now that his drug has gone. To his fevered mind, nothing can fill the emptiness except his drug. Can you imagine a life in which you refuse to enjoy a single word of approval and appreciation, or to lean on someone's arm, in which you depend on no one emotionally? So no one has the power to make you happy or miserable anymore? You refuse to need any particular person or to be special to anyone or to call anyone your own? Even the birds of the air have their nests and the foxes their holes, but you will have nowhere to rest your head in your journey through life. If you ever get to this state, you will at last know what it means to see with a vision that is clear and unclouded by fear or desire. And you will know what it means to love. But to come to this land of love, you have to pass through the pains of death. For to love persons is to have died to the need for persons, and to be utterly alone. How would you ever get there? By ceaseless awareness, and the infinite patience and compassion that you would have for a drug addict. It will also help you to undertake activities that you can do with your whole being, activities that you so much love to do, that while you are engaged in them, success or recognition or approval simply do not mean a thing to you. It will help, too, if you return to nature, send the crowds away and go up into the mountain and silently commune with trees and flowers and animals and birds, with sea and sky and clouds and stars. Then you will know that your heart has brought you into the vast desert of solitude. There is no one there by your side, absolutely no one. At first it will seem unbearable, but that is only because you are unaccustomed to aloneness. But if you manage to stay there for a while, the desert will suddenly blossom into love. Your heart will burst into song, and it will be springtime forever. Judge not. Judge not, that you be not judged. Matthew 7:1. It is a sobering thought that the finest act of love you can perform is not an act of service, but an act of contemplation, of seeing. When you serve people, you help, support, comfort, alleviate pain. When you see them in their inner beauty and goodness, you transform and create. Think of some of the people you like and are drawn to you. Now attempt to look at each of them as if you were seeing them for the first time, not allowing yourself to be influenced by your past knowledge or experience of them, whether good or bad. Look for things in them that you may have missed because of familiarity. For familiarity breeds staleness, blindness, and boredom. You cannot love what you cannot see afresh. You cannot love what you are not constantly discovering anew. Having done this, move on now to people you dislike. First observe what it is in them that you dislike. Study their defects impartially and with detachment. That means you cannot use labels like proud, lazy, selfish, arrogant. The label is an act of mental laziness, for it is easy to stick a label onto someone. It is difficult and challenging to see this person in his or her uniqueness. You must study those defects clinically. That means you must first make sure of your objectivity. Consider the possibility that what you see as a defect in them may not be a defect at all, but really something that your upbringing or conditioning have led you to dislike. If after this you see a defect there, understand that the origin of the defect lies in childhood experiences, past conditioning, faulty thinking and perception, and above all, in unawareness, not in malice. As you do this, your attitude will change into love and forgiveness, for to study, to observe, to understand is to forgive. Having made this study of defects, now search for the treasures buried in this person that your dislike prevented you from seeing before. And as you do this, observe any change of attitude or feeling that comes over you, for your dislike had clouded the vision and prevented you from seeing. You can now move on to each of the persons you live and work with, observing how each of them become transformed in your eyes when you look at them in this way. In seeing them thus, it is an infinitely more loving gift that you offer them than any act of service. For in doing this, you have transformed them. You have created them in your heart and given a certain amount of contact between you and them. They will be transformed in reality too. Now make this same gift to yourself. If you have been able to do it for others, that should be fairly easy. Follow the same procedure. No defect, no neurosis is judged or condemned. You have not judged others. You will be amazed now that you yourself are not being judged. Those defects are probed, studied, analyzed for a better understanding that leads to love and forgiveness. And you will discover in your joy that you are being transformed by this strangely loving attitude that rises within you toward this thing you call yourself. An attitude that rises within you and moves out through you to every living creature. Pluck out the eye. And if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better to enter life maimed than with two hands to go to hell. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into hell. Mark 9:43 FF. When you deal with blind people, it dawns on you that they are attuned to realities that you have no idea of. The sensitivity to the world of touch and smell and taste and sound is such as to make the rest of us seem like dull clods. We pity persons who have lost their sight, but rarely take into account the enrichment that their other senses offer them. It is a pity that those riches are bought at the heavy price of blindness, and it is quite conceivable that we could be as alive and finely attuned to the world as blind people are without the loss of our eyes. But it is not possible, not even conceivable, that you would ever awaken to the world of love unless you pluck out, chop off, those parts of your psychological being that we call attachments. If you refuse to do this, you will miss the experience of love. You miss the only thing that gives meaning to human existence, for love is the passport to abiding joy and peace and freedom. There is only one thing that blocks out entry into that world, and the name of that thing is attachment. It is produced by the lusting eye that excites craving within the heart, and by the grasping hand that reaches out to hold, possess, and make one's own, and refuses to let go. It is this eye that must be gouged out, this hand that must be cut off, if love is to be born. With those mutilated stubs for hands, you can grasp nothing anymore. With those empty sockets for eyes, you suddenly become sensitive to realities whose existence you have never suspected. Now at last you can love. Till now all you had was a certain good-heartedness and benevolence, a sympathy and concern for others, which you mistakenly took for love, but has as little in common with love as a flickering candle flame has with the light of the sun. What is love? It is a sensitivity to every portion of reality within you and without, together with a wholehearted response to that reality. Sometimes you will embrace that reality. Sometimes you will attack it. Sometimes you will ignore it. And at others, you will give it your fullest attention. But always you will respond not from need, but from sensitivity. And what of attachment? A need, a clinging that bursts your sensitivity, a drug that clouds your perception. That is why, as long as you have the slightest attachment for anything or any person, love cannot be born. For love is insensitivity, and sensitivity that is impaired, even in the slightest degree, is sensitivity destroyed. Just as the malfunctioning of one essential piece of a radar set distorts reception and distorts your response to what you perceive. There is no such thing as defective love or deficient love or partial love. Love, like sensitivity, either is in all its fullness or simply is not. You either have it whole or you have it not. So it is only when attachments disappear that one enters the boundless realm of spiritual freedom called love. One is now released to see and to respond. But you must not confound this freedom with the indifference of those who have never passed through the stage of attachment. How could you pluck out an eye or amputate a hand that you do not have? This indifference that so many people mistake for love, because they are attached to no one, they think that they love everyone, is not sensitivity, but hardening of the heart that has come about from rejection or disillusionment or the practice of renunciation. No, one must brave the stormy seas of attachment if one has to arrive at the land of love. Some people, never having set sail, have convinced themselves that they have arrived. One must be able-bodied and clear-sighted before the sword can do its work and the word of love can arise in one's awareness. And make no mistake, this is only achieved through violence. It is only the violent who carry off the kingdom. Why the violence? Because left to its own devices, life would never produce love. It would only lead to attraction, from attraction to pleasure, then to attachment, to satisfaction, which finally leads to wearisomeness and boredom. Then comes a plateau. Then, once again, the weary cycle. Attraction, pleasure, attachment, fulfillment, satisfaction, boredom. All of this mixed with the anxieties, the jealousies, the possessiveness, the sorrow, and the pain that make this cycle a roller coaster. When you have gone repeatedly around and around the cycle, a time finally comes when you have had enough and want to call a halt to the whole process. And if you are lucky enough not to run into something or someone else that catches your eye, you will have at least attained a fragile peace. That is the most that life can give you. And you can mistakenly equate this state with freedom, and you die without ever having known what it means to be really free and to love. No, if you wish to break out of the cycle and into the world of love, you must strike while the attachment is alive and raw, not when you have outgrown it. And you must strike not with the sword of renunciation, for that kind of mutilation only hardens, but with the sword of awareness. What must you be aware of? Three things. First, you must see the suffering that this drug is causing you, the ups and downs, the thrills, the anxieties and disappointments, the boredom to which it must inevitably lead. Second, you must realize that this drug is cheating you out of, namely, the freedom to love and to enjoy every minute and everything in life. Third, you must understand how, because of your addiction and your programming, you have invested the object of your attachment with a beauty and a value it simply does not have. What you are so enamored of is in your head, not in your beloved person or thing. See this, and the sword of awareness breaks the spell. It is commonly held that it is only when you feel deeply loved yourself that you are able to go out in love to others. This is not true. A man in love does indeed go out to the world, not in love, but in euphoria. For him, the world takes on an unreal rosy hue, which it loses the moment the euphoria dies. This so-called love is generated not by his clear perception of reality, but by the conviction, true or false, that he is loved by someone. A conviction that is dangerously fragile, because it is founded on the unreliable, changeable people who he believes love him, and who can at any moment pull the switch and turn off his euphoria. No wonder those who walk this path never really lose their insecurity. When you go out to the world because of the love that someone else has for you, you are all aglow, not with your perception of reality, but with the love that you have received from someone else. Someone else controls the switch, and when it is switched off, the glow fades away. As you use the sword of awareness to move from attachment into love, there is one thing you must keep in mind. Don't be harsh or impatient or hating of yourself. How can love grow out of such attitudes? But rather hold on to the compassion and the matter-of-factness with which the surgeon plies his knife. Then you may find yourself in the marvelous condition of loving the object of your attachment and in enjoying it even more than before, but simultaneously enjoying every other thing and every other person just as much. That is the litmus test for finding out if what you have is love. Far from being indifferent, you now enjoy everything and everyone just as much as you did the object of your attachment. Only now there are no more thrills, and therefore no more suffering and suspense. In fact, you could be said to be enjoying everything and enjoying nothing, because you have made the great discovery that what you are enjoying on the occasion of each thing and person is something within yourself. The orchestra is within you, and you carry it with you wherever you go. The things and people outside you merely determine what particular melody the orchestra will play. And when there is no one or nothing that has your attention, the orchestra will play a music of its own. It needs no outside stimulation. You now carry in your heart a happiness that nothing outside of you can put there and nothing can take away. Here then is the other test of love. You are happy for no reason that you know. Does this love last? There is no guarantee that it does. For while love cannot be partial, it can be of temporary duration. It comes and goes in the measure that your mind is aware and awake, or has gone off to sleep again. But this much is certain. Once you have had ever a fleeting taste of this thing called love, you will know that no price is too high, no sacrifice too great, not even the loss of one's eyes, nor the amputations of one's hand, if you can have in exchange the only thing in the world that makes your life worthwhile. Suffering and agony. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? Luke 24:26. Think of some of the painful events in your life. For how many of them are you grateful today? Because thanks to them you changed and grew. Here is a simple truth of life that most people never discover. Happy events make life delightful, but they do not lead to self-discovery and growth and freedom. That privilege is reserved to the things and persons and situations that cause us pain. Every painful event contains in itself a seed of growth and liberation. In the light of this truth, return to your life now and take a look at one or another of the events that you are not grateful for, and see if you can discover the potential for growth that they contain, which you were unaware of and therefore failed to benefit from. Think now of some recent event that caused you pain, that produced negative feelings in you. Whoever or whatever caused those feelings was your teacher, because they revealed so much to you about yourself that you probably did not know, and they offered you an invitation and a challenge to self-understanding, self-discovery, and therefore to growth in life and freedom. Try it out now. Identify the negative feeling that this event aroused in you. Was it anxiety or insecurity, jealousy or anger or guilt? What does that emotion say to you about yourself, your values, your way of perceiving the world and life, and above all, your programming and conditioning? If you succeed in discovering this, you will drop some illusion you have clung to till now, or you will change a distorted perception, or correct a false belief, or learn to distance yourself from your suffering, as you realize that it was caused by your programming and not by reality. And you will suddenly find that you are full of gratitude for those negative feelings and to that person or event that caused them. Now take this one step further. Look at everything that you think and feel and say and do that you do not like in yourself. Your negative emotions, your defects, your handicaps, your errors, your attachments and neurosis, and hang-ups, and yes, even your sins. Can you see every one of them as a necessary part of your development, holding out a promise of growth and grace for you and others? That would never have been there except for this thing that you so disliked. And if you have caused pain and negative feelings to others, were you not at that moment a teacher to them? An instrument that offered them a seed for self-discovery and growth? Can you see every one of them as a necessary part of your development, holding out a promise of growth and grace for you and others? That would never have been there except for this thing that you so disliked? And if you have caused pain and negative feelings to others, were you not at that moment a teacher to them, an instrument that offered them a seed for self-discovery and growth? Can you persist in this observation, in your observation, till you see all of this as a happy fault, a necessary sin that brings so much good to you and to the world? If you can, your heart will be flooded with peace and gratitude and love and acceptance of every single thing, and you will have discovered what people everywhere are searching for and never find, namely the fountainhead of serenity and joy that hides in every human heart. Fire on the Earth. I came to cast fire upon the earth, and would that it were already kindled. Luke chapter 12, 49. If you want to know what it means to be happy, look at a flower, a bird, a child. They are perfect images of the kingdom, for they live from moment to moment in the eternal now, with no past and no future. So they are spared the guilt and the anxiety that so torment human beings, and they are full of the sheer joy of living, taking delight not so much in persons or things as in life itself. As long as your happiness is caused or sustained by something or someone outside of you, you are still in the land of the dead. The day you are happy, for no reason whatsoever, the day you find yourself taking delight in everything and in nothing, you will know that you have found the land of unending joy called the kingdom. To find the kingdom is the easiest thing in the world, but also the most difficult. Easy because it is all around you and within you, and all you have to do is reach out and take possession of it. Difficult because if you wish to possess the kingdom, you may possess nothing else. That is, you must drop all inward leaning on any person or thing, withdrawing from them forever the power to thrill you, or excite you, or to give you a feeling of security or well-being. For this you first need to see with unflinching clarity this simple and shattering truth. Contrary to what your culture and religion have taught you, nothing, but absolutely nothing, can make you happy. The moment you see that, you will stop moving from one job to another, one friend to another, one place, one spiritual technique, one guru to another. None of these things can give you a single minute of happiness. They can only offer you a temporary thrill, a pleasure that initially grows in intensity, then turns into pain if you lose them, and into boredom if you keep them. Think of the numberless persons and things that so excited you in the past. What happened? In every single instance, they ended up by causing you suffering or boredom, did they not? It is absolutely essential that you see this, because till you do, there is no question of your ever finding the kingdom of joy. Mostly, people are not prepared to see till they have suffered repeated disillusionment and sorrow. And even then, only one in a million has the desire to see. They just keep going at it, pathetically knocking at the door of other creatures, begging bowl in hand, craving affection and approval and guidance and power and honor and success. For they obstinately refuse to understand that happiness is not in these things. If you search within your heart, you will find something there that will make it possible for you to understand. A spark of disenchantment and discontent, which, if fanned into flame, will become a raging forest fire that will burn up the whole of the illusory world you are living in, thereby unveiling to your wandering eyes the kingdom that you have always lived in unsuspectedly. Have you ever felt disgusted with life, sick at heart of constantly running away from fears and anxieties, weary of your begging rounds, exhausted from being dragged about hopelessly by your attachments and addictions? Have you ever felt the utter meaninglessness of working for a degree, then finding a job, then settling down to a life of boredom? Or if you are an achiever, settling down to a life of emotional turmoil caused by the things that you are chasing after? If you have, and is there a single human being who hasn't, the divine flame of discontent has arisen within your heart. Now is the time to feed it before it gets stamped out by the routine chores of life. Now is the holy season when you must simply find the time to get away and look at your life, allowing the flame to grow and grow as you look, refusing to let anything distract you from this task. Now is the time to see that absolutely nothing outside of you can bring you lasting joy. For the moment you do, that you will notice that a fear arises in your heart. That fear, that if you allow the discontent to be, it will turn into a raging passion that will grip you and cause you to revolt against everything that your culture and your religion hold dear, against the whole way of thinking and feeling and perceiving the world that they have brainwashed you into accepting. This devouring flame will cause you not just to rock the boat, but to burn the boat to ashes. Suddenly you will find yourself living in an altogether different world, infinitely removed from the world of the people around you. For everything that others hold dear, everything they are crying their hearts out for, honor, power, acceptance, approval, security, wealth, is seen for the stinking garbage that it is. It disgusts and nauseates. And everything others are forever running away from holds no terrors for you anymore. You have become serene and fearless and free, for you have stepped out of your illusory world and into the kingdom. Do not confound this divine discontent with the hopelessness and despair that sometimes drives people to madness and to suicide. That is not the mystical drive to life, but the neurotic drive to self-destruction. Do not confound it with the whining of people who are forever complaining about everything. These people are not mystics, but bores, merely agitating for improvement of prison conditions, whereas what they need to do is burst out of prison into freedom. Most people, when they feel the stirring of this discontent within their hearts, either run away from it and drug themselves with the fever pursuit of work and social life and friendship, or they channelize the discontent into social work, literature, music, the so-called creative pursuits that make them settle for reform, when what is needed is revolt. These people, even though they are full of activity, are not really alive at all. They are dead, content to live in the land of the dead. The test that your discontent is divine is the fact that it has no trace of sadness or bitterness in it at all. On the contrary, even though it often arouses fear within your heart, it is always accompanied by joy, the joy of the kingdom. And here is a parable of that kingdom. It is like a treasure lying buried in a field. The man who found it buried it again, and for sheer joy went and sold everything he had and bought that field. If you haven't found that treasure yet, don't waste your time searching for it. It can be found, but it may not be searched for. You don't have the slightest notion what the treasure is. All you are familiar with is the drugged happiness of your present existence. So what would you search for, and where? No, search rather in your heart for the spark of discontent, and tend the flame till it becomes a camouflagation, and your world is burned down to a heap of rubble. Young or old, most of us are discontented merely because we want something. More knowledge, a better job, a finer car, a bigger salary. Our discontent is based upon our desire for the more. It is only because we want something more that most of us are discontented. But I am not talking about that kind of discontent. It is the desire for the more that prevents clear thinking. Whereas if we are discontented, not because we want something, but without knowing what we want, if we are dissatisfied with our jobs, with making money, with seeking position and power, with tradition, with what we have and with what we might have, if we are dissatisfied not with anything in particular, but with everything, then I think we shall find that our discontent brings clarity. When we don't accept or follow, but question, investigate, penetrate, there is an insight out of which comes creativity, joy. Mostly the discontent that you feel comes from not having enough of something. You are dissatisfied because you think you do not have enough money or power or success or fame or virtue or love or holiness. This is not the discontent that leads to the joy of the kingdom. Its source is greed and ambition, and its fruit is restlessness and frustration. The day you are discontented, not because you want more of something, but without knowing what it is that you want. When you are sick at heart of everything that you have been pursuing so far, and you are sick of the pursuit itself, then your heart will attain a great clarity, an insight that will cause you mysteriously to delight in everything and in nothing. Consider the lilies. Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life. Look at the birds of the air. Consider the lilies of the field. Matthew 6, verse 25, FF. Everyone at some time or the other experiences feelings of what is known as insecurity. You feel insecure with the amount of money that you have in the bank, or the amount of love you are getting from your friend, or the type of educational background you have had. Or you have insecurity feelings regarding your health, or your age, or your physical appearance. If you were asked the question, "What is it that makes you feel insecure?" you would almost certainly give the wrong answer. You might say, "I don't have enough of the love of a friend," or "I don't have the kind of academic training that I need," or some such thing. In other words, you would point to some outside condition, not realizing that insecurity feelings are not generated by anything outside of you, but only by your emotional programming, by something you are telling yourself in your head. If you change your program, your insecurity feelings would vanish in a second, even though everything in the world outside remained exactly as it was before. One person feels quite secure with practically no money in the bank. Another feels insecure even though he has millions. It isn't the amount of money, but their programming that makes the difference. One person has no friends, yet feels perfectly secure in the love of people. Another feels insecure, even in the most possessive and exclusive of relationships. Again, the difference is in the programming. If you wish to deal with your feelings of insecurity, there are four facts that you must study well and understand. First, it is futile to ease your insecurity feelings by trying to change things outside of you. Your efforts may be successful, though mostly they are not. They may bring some relief, but the relief will be short-lived. So it is not worth the energy and time you spend in improving your physical appearance, or making more money, or getting further reassurances of love from your friends. Second, this fact will lead you to tackle the problem where it really is, inside your head. Think of the people who, in exactly the same condition that you find yourself in now, would not feel the slightest insecurity. There are such people. Therefore, the problem lies not with reality outside of you, but with you, in your programming. Third, you must understand that this programming of yours was picked up from insecure people, who, when you were very young and impressionable, taught you by their behavior and their panic reactions that every time the world outside did not conform to a certain pattern, you must create an emotional turmoil within yourself called insecurity, and you must do everything in your power to rearrange the outside world, make more money, seek more reassurances, placate and please the people you have offended, etc., etc., in order to make the insecurity feelings go away. The mere realization that you don't have to do this, that doing this really solves nothing, and that the emotional turmoil is caused solely by you and your culture, this realization alone distances you from the problem and brings considerable relief. Fourth, whenever you are insecure about what may happen in the future, just remember this. In the past 6 months or 1 year, you were so insecure about events which, when they finally came, you were able to handle somehow. Thanks to the energy and the resources that that particular present moment gave you, and not to all the previous worrying, which only made you suffer needlessly and weaken you emotionally. So say to yourself, if there is anything I can do about the future right now, I shall do it. Then I'm going to just leave it alone and settle down to enjoy the present moment, because all the experience of my life has shown me that I can only cope with things when they are present, not before they occur, and that the present always gives me the resources and the energy I need to deal with them. The final disappearance of insecurity feelings will only come when you have attained that blessed ability of the birds of the air and the flowers of the field to live fully in the present, one moment at a time. The present moment, no matter how painful, is never unbearable. What is unbearable is what you think is going to happen in 5 hours or in 5 days, and those words you keep saying in your head, words like, this is terrible, this is unbearable, how long is this going to last, and so on. Birds and flowers are blessed above humans in that they have no concept of the future, no words in their heads, and no anxiety about what their fellows think of them. That is why they are such perfect images of the kingdom. So do not be anxious about tomorrow. Tomorrow will look after itself. Each day has troubles enough of its own. Set your mind on God's kingdom before everything else, and all the rest will come to you as well. Lost and found. He who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it. Matthew 10:39. Has it ever struck you that those who most fear to die are the ones who most fear to live? That in running away from death, we are running away from life? Think of a man living in an attic, a little hole of a place with no light and little ventilation. He fears to come down the stairs because he has heard of people falling downstairs and breaking their necks. He would never cross the street because he has heard of thousands who have been run over on the streets. And of course, if he cannot cross a street, how will he cross an ocean or a continent or one world of ideas to another? This man clings to his hole of an addict in the attempt to ward off death, and in doing so he has simultaneously warded off life. What is death? A loss, a disappearance, a letting go, a saying goodbye. When you cling, you refuse to let go. You refuse to say goodbye. You resist death. And even though you may not realize it, That is when you resist life too. For life is on the move and you are stuck. Life flows and you have become stagnant. Life is flexible and free and you are rigid and frozen. Life carries all things away and you crave for stability and permanence. So you fear life and you fear death because you cling. When you cling to nothing, when you have no fear of losing anything, then you are free to flow like the mountain stream that is always fresh and sparkling and alive. There are people who cannot bear the thought of losing a relative or a friend. They prefer not to think of it, or they dread to challenge and lose a pet theory or ideology or belief, or they are convinced that they are never able to live without this or that precious person, place, or thing. Do you want a way to measure the degree of your rigidity and your deadness? Observe the amount of pain you experience when you lose a cherished idea or person or thing. The pain and grief betray your clinging, do they not? Why is it that you grieve so much at the death of a loved one or the loss of a friend? You never took the time to seriously consider that all things change and pass away and die. So death and loss and separation take you by surprise. You choose to live in a little attic of your illusion, pretending that things will never change, that things will always be the same. That is why, when life bursts in to shatter your illusion, you experience so much pain. In order to live, you must look reality in the face, and then you will shed your fear of losing people and develop a taste for newness and change and uncertainty. You will shed your fear of losing the known and expectantly wait and welcome the unfamiliar and the unknown. If it is life you seek, then here is an exercise that might prove painful, but will bring the exhilaration of freedom if you are able to do it. Ask yourself if there is anything or anyone whose loss would cause you grief. You may be one of those persons who cannot bear to even think of the death or loss of a parent, a friend, a loved one. If this is so, and in the measure that this is so, you are dead. The thing to do is to face the death, the loss, the separation from loved things and loved ones now. Take these persons and things one at a time and imagine they are dead or lost or separated from you forever, and in your heart say goodbye. To each of them, say thank you and goodbye. You will experience pain and you will experience the disappearance of clinging. And then something else will emerge in your consciousness, an aloneness, a solitude that grows and grows, becomes like the infinite vastness of the sky. In that aloneness is freedom. In that solitude is life. In that non-clinging is the willingness to flow and to enjoy and to taste and to relish each new moment of life, which is now made all the sweeter because it is freed from the anxiety and tension and insecurity, freed from the fear of loss and death that always accompanies the desire for permanence and clinging. The lamp of the body. Your eye is the lamp of your body. When your eye is sound, your whole body is full of light. But when it is not sound, your body is full of darkness. Luke 11:34. We think the world would be saved if only we could generate larger quantities of goodwill and tolerance. That's false. What will save the world is not goodwill and tolerance, but clear thinking. Of what use is it to be tolerant of others if you are convinced that you are right and everyone else who disagrees with you is wrong? That isn't tolerance, but condescension. That leads not to union of hearts, but to division. Because you are one up and the others one down. A position that can only lead to a sense of superiority on your part and resentment on your neighbors, thereby breeding further intolerance. True tolerance only arises from a keen awareness of the abysmal ignorance of everyone as far as truth is concerned. For truth is essentially mystery. The mind can sense but cannot grasp it, much less formulate it. Our beliefs can point to it, but cannot put it into words. In spite of this, people talk glowingly about the value of dialogue, which at worst is a camouflaged attempt to convince the other person of the rightness of your position, and at best will prevent you from becoming a frog in the well who thinks that his well is the only world there is. What happens when frogs from different wells assemble to dialogue about their convictions and experiences? Their horizons widen to include the existence of wells other than their own. But they still have no suspicion of the existence of the ocean of truth that cannot be confined within the walls of conceptual wells. And our poor frogs continue to be divided and to speak in terms of yours and mine, your experience, your convictions, your ideology, and mine. The sharing of formulas does not enrich the sharers, for formulas like the walls of wells divide. Only the unrestricted ocean unites. But to arrive at this ocean of truth that is unbounded by formulas, it is essential to have the gift of clear thinking. What is clear thinking? And how does one arrive at it? The first thing you must know is that it does not call for any great learning. It is so simple as to be within the reach of a 10-year-old child. What is needed is not learning, but unlearning. Not talent, but courage. You will understand this if you think of a little child in the arms of an old, disfigured housemaid. The child is too young to have picked up the prejudices of its elders. So when it snuggles in that woman's arms, it is responding not to labels in its head, labels like white woman, black woman, ugly, pretty, old, young, mother, servant maid. It is responding not to labels such as these, but to reality. The woman meets the child's need for love, and that is the reality the child responds to, not the woman's name and figure, and religion, and race, and sect. Those are totally, absolutely irrelevant. The child has, as yet, no beliefs and no prejudices. This is the environment within which clear thinking can occur. And to achieve it, one must drop everything one has learned and achieve the mind of the child that is innocent of past experiences and programming which so cloud our way of looking at reality. Look into yourself and examine your reactions to persons and situations, and you will be appalled to discover the prejudiced thinking behind your reactions. It is almost never the concrete reality of this person or thing that you are responding to. You are responding to principles, ideologies, belief systems, economic, political, religious, psychological belief systems, to preconceived ideas and prejudices, whether positive or negative. Take them one at a time, each person and thing and situation, and search for your bias, separating the reality here before you from your programmed perceptions and your projections. And this exercise will afford you a revelation as divine as any that the scriptures could provide you with. Prejudices and beliefs are not the only enemies of clear thinking. There is another pair of enemies called desire and fear. Thinking that is uncontaminated by emotion, namely by desire and fear and self-interest, calls for an asceticism that is terrifying. People mistakenly assume that their thinking is done by their head. It is done actually by the heart, which first dictates the conclusion, then commands the head to provide the reasoning that will defend it. So here is another source of divine revelation. Examine some of the conclusions that you have arrived at and see how they are adulterated by self-interest. This is true of every conclusion, unless you hold it provisionally. Think how tightly you hold on to your conclusions regarding people, for instance. Are those judgments completely free of emotion? If you think they are, you have probably not looked hard enough. This is the major cause of disagreements and divisions between nations and individuals. Your interests do not coincide with mine, so your thinking and your conclusions do not agree with mine. How many people do you know whose thinking is at least sometimes opposed to their self-interest? How many times can you recall having engaged in that kind of thinking yourself? How often have you succeeded in placing an impenetrable barrier between the thinking going on in your head and the fears and desires that agitate your heart? Each time you attempt that task, you will understand that what clear thinking calls for is not intelligence. That is easily come by. But the courage that has successfully coped with fear and with desire. For the moment you desire something or fear something, your heart will consciously or unconsciously get in the way of your thinking. This is a consideration for spiritual giants who have come to realize that in order to find truth, they need not doctrinal formulations, but a heart that divests itself of its programming and its self-interest each time that thinking is in progress. A heart that has nothing to protect and owes nothing to ambition and therefore leaves the mind to roam unfeathered, fearless, and free in search of truth. A heart that is ever ready to accept new evidence and to change its views. Such a heart then becomes a lamp that enlightens the darkness of the whole body of humanity. If all human beings were fitted with such hearts, people would no longer think of themselves as communists or capitalists, as Christians or Muslims or Buddhists. The very clarity of their thinking would show them that all thinking, all concepts, all beliefs are lamps full of darkness, signs of their ignorance. And in that realization, the walls of their separate wells would collapse, and they would be invaded by the ocean that unites all people in the truth. Be ready. Therefore you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Matthew 24:44. Sooner or later, there arises in every human heart the desire for holiness, spirituality, God, call it what you will. One hears mystics speak of a divinity all around them that is within their grasp, that would make our lives meaningful and beautiful and rich. If we could only discover it. People have some sort of a vague idea as to what this thing is, and they read books and consult gurus in the attempt to find out what it is that they must do to gain this elusive thing called holiness or spirituality. They pick up all sorts of methods, techniques, spiritual exercises, formulas. Then after years of fruitless striving, they become discouraged and confused and wonder, what went wrong? Mostly, they blame themselves. If they had practiced their techniques more regularly, if they had been more fervent or more generous, they might have made it. But made what? They have no clear idea as to what exactly this holiness that they seek is, but they certainly know that their lives are still in a mess. They still become anxious and insecure and fearful, resentful and unforgiving, grasping and ambitious and manipulated of people. So once again, they throw themselves with renewed vigor into the effort and labor that they think they need to gain their goal. They have never stopped to consider this simple fact. Their efforts are going to get them nowhere. Their efforts will only make things worse, as things become worse when you use fire to put out fire. Effort does not lead to growth. Effort, whatever the form it may take, whether it be willpower or habit, or a technique, or a spiritual exercise, does not lead to change. At best, it leads to repression and a covering over of the root disease. Effort may change the behavior, but it does not change the person. Just think what kind of a mentality it betrays when you ask, "What must I do to get holiness?" Isn't it like asking, how much money must I spend to buy something? What sacrifice must I make? What discipline must I undertake? What meditation must I practice in order to get it? Think of a man who wants to win the love of a woman and attempts to improve his appearance or build his body or change his behavior and practice techniques to charm her. You truly win the love of others not by the practice of techniques, but by being a certain kind of person. And that is never achieved through effort and techniques. And so it is with spirituality and holiness. Not what you do is what brings it to you. This is not a commodity that one can buy or prize that one can win. What matters is what you are, what you become. Holiness is not an achievement. It is a grace. A grace called awareness. A grace called looking, observing, understanding. If you would only switch on the light of awareness and observe yourself and everything around you throughout the day, if you would see yourself reflected in the mirror of awareness the way you see your face reflected in a looking glass, that is, accurately, clearly, exactly, as it is without the slightest distortion or addition, and if you observe this reflection without any judgment or condemnation, you would experience all sorts of marvelous changes coming about in you. Only, you will not be in control of those changes, or be able to plan them in advance, or decide how and when they are to take place. It is this non-judgmental awareness alone that heals and changes and makes one grow, but in its own way and in its own time. What specifically are you to be aware of? Your reactions and your relationships. Each time you are in the presence of a person, or with nature, or with any particular situation, you have all sorts of reactions, positive and negative. Study those reactions. Observe what exactly they are and where they come from, without any sermonizing or guilt, or even any desire, much less effort, to change them. That is all that one needs for holiness to arise. But isn't awareness itself an effort? Not if you have tasted it even once. For then you will understand that awareness is a delight, the delight of a little child moving out in wonder to discover the world. For even when awareness uncovers unpleasant things in you, it always brings liberation and joy. Then you will know that the unaware life is not worth living. It is too full of darkness and pain. If at first there is a sluggishness in practicing awareness, don't force yourself. That would be an effort again. Just be aware of your sluggishness without any judgment or condemnation. You will then understand that awareness involves as much effort as a lover makes to go to his beloved, or a hungry man makes to eat his food, or a mountaineer to get to the top of his beloved mountain. So much energy expended, so much hardship, even. But it isn't effort, it's fun. In other words, awareness is an effortless activity. Will awareness bring you the holiness you so desire? Yes and no. The fact is, you will never know. For true holiness, the type that is not achieved through techniques and efforts and repression, true holiness is completely unself-conscious. You wouldn't have the slightest awareness of its existence in you. Besides, you will not care, for even the ambition to be holy will have dropped as you live from moment to moment, a life made full and happy and transparent through awareness. It is enough for you to be watchful and awake, for in this state your eyes will see the Savior, nothing else, but absolutely nothing else, not security, not love, not belonging, not beauty, not power, not holiness. Nothing else will matter anymore.